discussed today, Senate Bill 472 and Senate Bill 426. Senator Halper has made his appearance. We have a committee substitute from Senator Petrula, who is the prime author of SB 472, which changes the title. The committee substitute permits relevant hearsay evidence of a victim age 16 or under in grand jury proceedings, even if the information would not be admissible in a trial for the purpose of initiating prosecutions under the sexual assault of a minor statutes in AS 11, Chapter 41, 440 to 445. And we have witnesses to hear on this matter. Deborah Heidecker for Senator Petrula.
The main intention of this bill is to protect the constitutional right of the defendant, but allow for maybe less trauma for the victim in some cases. And since grand jury proceedings have less restrictions on them than regular trial proceedings, this seemed like a good place to allow hearsay evidence of either a child, relating to sexual offense against a child. And we changed the committee substitute changes line 14. And by the way, I just was made aware by Gilbert if there's a typo, and that should be 11.41, 455 instead of 445. And it now reads hearsay evidence of a statement of a child 16 years of age or younger. And that could be another child testifying what the alleged victim told that child.
Well, it could be an adult. Saying what the child told the adult.
It could be an adult saying what an alleged victim told another child. The reason there's a committee substitute is because the most recent version of this bill said preliminary hearings and said grand jury proceedings, and preliminary hearings are rare.
So the original bill talked about preliminary hearings, and that is uncustomary. It's often waived. Or the grand jury indicts, particularly in these kinds of cases, before any preliminary hearing is held.
And I guess a lot of cases never go to trial. A lot of these kinds of cases never go to trial, so it would be conceivable that the victim wouldn't have to testify in the grand jury, and then there wouldn't be a trial, so they would never have to testify publicly.
Okay, thank you. Gail Horetzky.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Gail Horetzky. I'm from the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. I'm here to testify on CS for Senate Bill 472. As Ms. Heidecker stated, the present committee substitute, which I understand you have in front of you, allows the introduction of hearsay evidence at the grand jury of a statement of a child under 16 describing the conduct of establishing certain sexual offenses. There are basically two forms, generally speaking, that hearsay evidence would take. One is when a child does testify, but say, and this happens quite a bit, the way that the assault is discovered is a young child in her own home will say something to her father, like asking the father questions about sexual relations or what men do and stuff. And the father will just be real startled by the question because it shows a degree of sophistication that is inappropriate to that age. And will, you know, ask the child, well, why do you say so? And she said, well, because Susie's dad does that, or you know, something that comes out, and then they investigate, and then ultimately a prosecution results. The child's initial statements to the father reporting the incident are not admissible at the grand jury because it's hearsay. It's a statement made outside of the grand jury. So the jury never hears the way the child initially described the sexual contact or told the story. What they hear is a scared young child sitting in a room with a bunch of strangers in front of a microphone attempting to describe this behavior which occurred between her and adult, her and an adult. And often it won't be nearly as full or accurate or convincing as the statement that the child initially made to a trusted adult such as a parent or a school teacher. So that's one form. And in that situation, the child would testify, but you'd also have the father come in and say, yes, my 4-year-old daughter told me what 7-year-old did, blah, 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 blah. The other situation where it would come up is that you would have a very young child, 3 or 4 years old, perhaps younger, but if the child isn't verbal, you almost never have a case anyway, unless there's physical harm, physical evidence, where the child would be interviewed by an experienced social worker or an experienced police officer, sometimes videotaped, sometimes using dolls or play, sitting on the floor, that sort of a non-threatening atmosphere, and the child will be judged too young to come into the grand jury because the social worker or the therapist says that child just can't go through that trauma, or because the DA has discovered through interviewing the child that he or she is not likely to be able to say anything faced with that kind of a threatening, traumatic audience, that you would actually have the police officer, the social worker, or a videotape come in and be played for the grand jury. So the grand jury in that situation would not actually hear the victim in person at all, would hear either the videotape or would hear the police officer's descriptions of the statements made by the victim. And that's the second situation in which this type of a bill would be of use to prosecutors in prosecuting sexual assault cases. And as Ms. Heidepper said, although obviously it's up to the defendant, it depends on the individual case, a great percentage of these cases, once an indictment is obtained, do not go to trial. That percentage has lessened somewhat. That is, the ones that don't go to trial, that percentage has lessened somewhat with the advent of presumptive sentencing. But still, you have a fair number of these cases which never go to trial. So if the child were spared the trauma of testifying at grand jury, there's a good chance that he or she would never have to testify, that the man would actually plead guilty or confess, and then we'll get to the judge as to sentencing without inflicting additional trauma on the child.
Essentially, what we're saying, and this is testimony that the grand jury investigation, whatever you call it, proceeds,
yes,
rather than an open court proceeding.
Yes, sir,
it is hearsay even in this proceeding.
Yes, sir, it is.
On this,
Mr. Chairman, it's anything that's any testimony about any statement that's offered outside of the court proceeding that's going on right at that moment is technically hearsay if it's offered for the truth of the matter asserted. So this would allow a police officer or a parent to say, my daughter told me, say that to the grand jury.
But it hasn't been so up to this point. We're allowing it to occur now.
With certain very narrow exceptions, hearsay evidence is not admissible at grand jury right now.
Senator Fisher.
Please say the same thing. I was not aware that there were such strict rules of evidence before grand jury. I thought grand jury required a finding, just sort of a presumption that crime probably occurred or something like that. And why is hearsay evidence not admissible?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Fisher, because again, with certain narrow exceptions, such as lab reports and stuff like that, our criminal rules say, and the court interpretation of those criminal rules say, hearsay is not admissible. Alaska, in grand jury, at grand jury, Alaska has the most strict rules regarding evidence in the grand jury of any state in the union, and is far and away beyond the federal system. In the federal system, hearsay is admissible at grand jury, because grand jury does fill the function you described, which is a probable cause determination. In the state of Alaska, there have been specific rulings that you cannot, well, the rule says you can't have hearsay absent, quote, compelling justification, unquote. And there have been many, many decisions by our Supreme Court as to what compelling justification is. And they have specifically said that the absence of a witness out of state, even if that witness would be present at trial, is not compelling justification. So that means if we have a case that, you know, requires 7 or 8 witnesses, 2 of whom are out of state, we have to fly up for grand jury and to get a trial. This is a major problem in Bush, where you have something that happens in Kaktovik, and then you have to fly people into Bethel or Barrow or the major population center for grand jury. You may have to fly 7 people from the village for the grand jury. requested, and then we have all your arraignments and omnibus hearing from there. Since there is no Sixth Amendment right to confrontation at grand jury, you don't have that issue here. It's possible that a defendant could raise a due process right to the admission of hearsay evidence in front of grand jury. All I can answer you on that, sir, is that in the federal system and all other states that use grand jury, hearsay is freely admissible, and that has been upheld all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Does the bill require two-thirds vote to ever change?
Yes, sir, it does.
Well, I'm saying this because in reading the head notes to cases, a vital function of the grand jury is the protection of the innocent against oppression and unjust prosecution. The purpose served by grand jury indictment is to get one accused of a serious offense the benefit of having a private citizen's judge. When there is probable cause to hold the accused for trial, this theoretically acts as a check on the DA's power to initiate criminal prosecutions and ensures the protection of the innocent against oppression and unjust prosecution. It would seem to me that there will be litigation.
Oh, I'll guarantee it. Absolutely.
Seems to me that probably from a health, education, social services perspective, we should refer the bill on. It has no referral to judiciary. And then the judiciary can begin to look at it from a constitutional six. The new committee substitute three rights and existing statute, which was the old statute which was provided for small scholarship for Native students. And that is of doubtful constitutionality to begin with. So the new committee substitute tenders this in terms of rural students, defining rural as a district in which the largest community has a population of 40,000 or less, which is the same definition used by Speaker Hayes, I think, in the House bill that he sent to the Senate, which is one of the Senate's issues.
Why are you okay with this bill?
Because the Hayes bill really addresses it in a different way. It addresses it in terms of changing the post-secondary loan program by raising the amount lendable to a student if the student is rural and wants to be a teacher. And then it provides different forgiveness provisions for teachers who go back to Bush. And this, that ran into some problems with the Judiciary Committee over setting up a separate class for treatment of the post-secondary education commission with a separate amount that could be borrowed and a separate difference. This bill relates to the UVA scholarship program and amends an existing law on university class of scholarships. And the scholarship nomination of the bill would be awarded by the Board of Regents, but would be made, but the nominations would be made by the local school districts. We have inserted a findings and purpose section to try to strengthen constitutionality. We ask that we provide that priority will be given to those who are interested in education, but it's not limited to Native students who want to be teachers. Nancy, do you want to take us through this section by section?
Finding it a session.
Mr. Chairman. I read that, and I read that for you. It's also, I think that there ought to be more flexibility that you shouldn't fix it, either not fix it in law at all, or give it 5 years just to write a little bit more at all.
Well, what I'm prepared to say is to be a family structure for more than 5 years. Period.
Necessary to receive a bachelor's degree. Somewhere in there, and shall be made available for any student taking whatever is a minimum full time course.
I'm not sure this language does it. There's a sort of mixed up implication. On the one hand, scholarships will be awarded on the basis of funds available. On the other hand, on page 2, line 6, if a school board that is entitled to nominate, does this award regents shall make the scholarship available to a student from another, it makes it sound as if nomination is tantamount to admission and tantamount to award of scholarship.
Let's do it this way. Let's take out that sentence, and school board is entitled to nominate a student for
for a scholarship that's not too supportive, you should show up the scholarship available, et cetera. And go back to the precedent acceptance and say, the board shall award scholarships based on the nominations received from school boards and shall consider nominations on a geographically applicable basis. That solves that problem.
What does sentence mean? The board shall award scholarships based on the nominations received from the boards.
Means that they cannot
pick somebody who's not been nominated as 400.
Yes. Okay, and then do you want to say that it maintains a grade average, going to assume or better? And it's enrolled in the full academic program of folding, so yeah, okay. And then what do you want to do with the next sentence about 4 years?
It's all the time he needs to get both taken full academic program.
All right. So it's right, he's not entitled to scholarship for more than the number of years necessary to receive a bachelor's degree and take out the first degree. Okay, yes.
This reads as if the local school board must make sure that the person is qualified before they nominate the student. May leave a question of whether the student, the prospective student, has to be admitted or not if nominated. If you don't be real clear that the award of the scholarship based on the determination that the student was
for a scholarship.